pretty good.
Great. You are too.
Good, good, good. You want to start out by talking a little bit about your project and you have a tour?
Yes, well, you know, it's all related to basically what you want to talk about. I mean, you want to talk about my work in Land of Osiris. And this year, and, you know, it's real interesting that we're doing this just about a year since we did the last one. I noticed that we talked just about a year ago.
Is it down to the day? Sometimes I do that. I don't know.
It was the 22nd and this is the 28th, but that's pretty close.
Wow. That's
it. It's great.
Mm-hmm.
But this year will be 10 years since my teacher, Hakim, passed. And that's a lot of what the book, of course, is about, the teachings that I got from him. And so I'm going to be involved with a tour and a video project that's going to be celebrating his life and the way he did it. I'm going to be returning to doing tours the way that he did them. We sort of like slipped away in the last couple of years with the tours we've done, but we're now going to return to more pure of the way he did tours.
You do a lot of tours with Brian Forrester, too, don't you?
Well, yes, but sort of we have sort of gone different ways now. Brian's in Egypt actually right now, going to be doing a tour with Hugh Newman. And, we've done some tours together over the last couple of years. That's why I say we've sort of slipped away. The way Hakim used to do tours, and this is what I'm going to talk about because it's so much part of his teachings, was he was the best teacher that I've ever known to using both sides of the brain. In other words, you know, giving you the information, feeding the left brain, telling you what the glyphs mean, what the temples are, what the stone is about, what was the physical understanding of the culture, but to have the experience, the right brain experience. And we sort of slipped away from that in the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a master because he knew, because of his life experience, and that's what we're going to be concentrating on, this documentary we're going to do about him, talking more about his life, is that he knew from a young age when all around Egypt what would we call the power plate spots in each part, each site, each area, which we call the Holy of Holies, where the energy is centered. And he would take his groups there, and not just to give you the information, but to experience it, to meditate, to feel the energy, because these sites are all known for having running water going underneath it, a natural source of crystal, and crystalline stone, igneous rock, and all of that acting together gave the energy that what we call power places and where pyramids and temples are located all around our planet.
Did the, and I think you call them, you don't call them Egyptians, you call them Kemetians.
Yes, because it was my work with Hakim, and that's what Land of Osiris introduces, is that he, the uniqueness that he was, because he was born within a couple hundred yards of the Giza Plateau in the village that sits right there. So he spent 82 years of his life being right in that energy field. And from a young boy, I would say he was 75 years a field archaeologist, because as a young boy, he was sent out by his uncle, his beloved maternal uncle, Uncle Zaki, who was a licensed antiquities merchant and used to have legal right to sell antiquities through the Turkish and British authorities at the time. This is around the turn of the 20th century. And so Hakim, as a young boy, would go out with all the village boys. They'd run around the plateau and try to find little things, bring back, and he'd give them some money for it. And he was so fascinated. He'd walk into a tomb. In those days, you could just walk into a tomb. And as a boy of about 6 years old, he would look up at the walls and say, I have to know what's written on the walls. I have to know it. So he became, then his archaeology became his life. And through, you know, the long story, make it short, which we're going to document, through his uncle's influence, he got to be a university student and became a field archaeologist, credentialed in the dual degrees in archaeology and Egyptology from Fouad University, which is today Cairo University. So he had both sides of it. And he became a mystic. He was trained by the Sufis. So he was able to walk in both worlds, what we call the metaphysical spiritual world and the academic world, and which I did too. And this is why he chose me to be his student. He had many students, but I was the one that had that kind of background like he did, and the love of archaeology. And so that's where it came from. So then looking around and studying on his own, he'd be able to move past the academic training that he had as in Egyptology, and saw that there were many, many holes in the theories, that it didn't explain what he was noticing, what he was feeling, what he was experiencing. And so he developed his own teaching, his own idea of a previous civilization to what we call the dynasties. And I was the one who came along and just put the label on it, and we called Kemetology, because the ancient civilization by its own name was called Kemet, K-M-T, Kemet, the Black Land. the land that the blacks, the soil that the Nile she deposits, that became the basis of the civilization, the black land. And that was the civilization. So we call it Kemetology as opposed to Egyptology. Hmm. And he had the system. I put the label on it. And since the 10 years now that this August that he's passed, it has only increased because what we have now brought in is much more science, as you say, other researchers like Brian Foster, but people, engineers like Christopher Dunn, geologists like Robert Schock, and many, many, many other engineers and geologists who've now come to Egypt with me in the last 20 years that I've been doing tours, and chemists, physicists, and other archaeologists, so that now we have a strong scientific background and basis for what we're teaching. But we don't want to move away from the spiritual, which is that when we promise a tour to people, and that's what we're going to be doing in September, and we'll give the details before we're done, is to have that experience. Because myself and the others that many people who've come to me with, you know, and again, I've done over 20 tours. This will be, I've been to Egypt 22 times in the last 25 and a half years. So I've done many, many different tours, many, many different people. And it's that life-changing experience that we like to have to people to have, to experience that energy for himself, to realize, as Hakim always would teach us, the sight dictates what's there. Meaning, we as humans have always been attracted to energy zones of the planet. As I said, a power place, what we call a sacred site, where now we know there are pyramids, temples of ancient people, because being attracted there, that's why you wanted to concentrate your energy. So people can just go, hopefully open-minded, without any preconceptions, and experience that energy at these sites, and have some, many, many, many people have a life-altering experience.
Can you tell us about Dr. Kinnaman and who found the documents that talked about the anti-gravitation machines?
Well, he started my interest. It was the interest in Kinnaman. We never were able to follow up to fully document things, but it was a tape recording that I heard when I was involved with the Rosicrucian Order in San Jose, California in the late 70s. And I was a staff research scientist. And one of the people ranking Rosicrucian had asked me if I ever heard the name J.O. Kinnaman. And I said, no, at that time I had never heard. Gave me a video audio tape to listen to. And it was a lecture that Kinnaman gave in the early 50s to a group of Masons, which he said that he had worked with the great Sir Walter Flinders Petrie in the late 19th century in Egypt. And they had found another entrance into the Great Pyramid, went underground, found many things, including, he said, evidences of machines, anti-gravity machines, that were used to build the pyramid, and documents, he claimed, from Atlantis, or documents. But we don't believe he found any written things, if he found anything, because we're talking about civilizations way before writing. And so, and some people think there was writing in Atlantis, but that's never been proven. Hmm. But if we're talking about ancient Egypt, ancient Kemet, there was not writing before around 4,000 BCE. Or we could take it back to 6,000 BCE, but not before then. We're talking about previous to 10,000 years ago. But this was, you know, we never were able to confirm Kinnaman's finds, but it does fit into what Hakim taught, that the pyramids were taught by were built by anti-gravity using sound. Mm-hmm. To create anti-gravity fields, that's the only way you could lift the kind of mega tonnage we're talking about. And we're talking about incredible weights that we see the ancient people could throw around like it was nothing. And we've only accomplished that in the modern age with modern cranes in the last 20 to 50 years, that we can even lift the kind of weights that it's obvious these ancient Kemetians, we say, not Egyptians, did. Of over 50 tons, 100 tons, 500 tons. We see an obelisk that's laying in situ because it had a crack in it, was not finished, at the site of Aswan, which everybody takes their tour groups go. The unfinished obelisk is a famous site. It's about 110 feet long, estimated to weigh 1,100 tons. One single piece of what's called syenite granite. And they had every intention to finish this piece and lift it in position. So the only way it's possible that could have been done, except from some bizarre extraterrestrial theories, which many people have, is by using anti-gravity.
I forget which page of your book it is, but I really enjoyed this. It's an interesting statement by Hakim. He stated that the Sphinx was well over 50,000 years old.
she was the basis of my connection to him, because I at about 8 years old, I opened up a book of National Geographic and I looked at a picture of the Sphinx and the Great Pyramid. And to be honest, I've never been the same since. It instilled in me incredible love of anything ancient Egypt until it finally became my life's work, which is about 50 years ago now. But it was from 8 years old, and it's always been the Sphinx. My connection has always been through her. And when I first met Hakim, he was standing in front of the Sphinx. This is now over 26 years. It'll be going on 26 years ago, 1992. He was standing in front of the Sphinx, and he's calmly talking to our group, and he just turns around and looks over his shoulder to her, as he mentioned, and calmly said she's 54,000 years old.
Wow.
And I was like, went into an altered state when he said that, and I looked at her, and she, which I've always had a connection to, and I say these things straight up, and whether people want to believe them or not, I don't really care. She said to me right then and there, "This is the man you've been looking for all your life. This is your teacher. He is my son." And that became my tutelage with him. It was through the Sphinx. And yes, we say the Sphinx was the first thing carved above ground. We have things we think are older than her. And those are the tunnels that are under the Giza Plateau, which are artificially created to bring water to the site, because water was a source of the energy for the pyramids. They were machines, not tombs. But she, as a representation of the Great Mother, was the first thing carved on the surface.
That's and interesting, he would say, because didn't Kinnaman, Dr. O'Kinnaman, claim that the face of the Sphinx was a woman? Didn't he have the same?
Yes, he said that in 1940. One of the only American Egyptologists who ever made that statement. He said that in a book that he wrote in 1940, that the face of the Sphinx was that of a woman. No one else was saying that at that time, except the indigenous wisdom keepers who Hakim met as a young boy and would tell him these stories. What he did is he put it all together. He was an amazing man. Unique in that respect is that he would go to each site as a young man, going through his teenage years, through his 20s, through getting his academic degrees and becoming a credentialed Egyptologist, and meet the wisdom keepers, the elders, who knew all the things about their particular site, which was handed down from father to son as an Islamic sense. The original culture was matriarchal. We can get into that. But in the modern times, it's been father to son handed down. Hmm. And he would piece it together. He would see the wisdom from each site and see that there was a system that the ancients had long before what the so-called dynasties and what Egyptology thinks was Egypt. And so he put it together as a system. But he did that by going to each site and knowing where the energy was centered at each site, what we call the netters, which were not gods and goddesses. They were principles of divine creation. And later became a religion, became out of that idea. But you see, this is one of the things that people really don't understand who started to learn Egyptology and just see it from an academic sense. They think these people were just polytheistic. They had all these hundreds of gods and goddesses, and they did all these things, and they had really these superstitious things about death, that they were going to live forever, and blah, 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 without realizing that what they're linking underneath all of that is the basis of all our modern religions. And that's what I document in my second book, From Light into Darkness, how our modern patriarchal religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, all came out of the religion of the so-called dynastic times, of modern historical times, of Egypt, when the principles of creation then became created into deity and religion came in. And it's a long story, and it's what we're going to be documenting in the video and documenting for sure on the tour, how religion came to be through a distortion from spirituality to a descent into religion.
Did the ancient Kemetans use both the left and the right brain?
Absolutely. They used 360 senses. This is one of the amazing things of Hakim's teachings. He would teach us they were innately born with 360 senses.
Hmm.
150 we label feminine, 180 we label feminine, 180 we label masculine. These are the so-called gods and goddesses, the netters. But he said, if we think you only have five, we limit ourselves. He would say to us, he would be very polite to an audience, especially a Western audience, "I don't want to insult people, but we are crippled today," he would say. "If you think you only have five senses, you limit yourself." And he would use examples like someone would say, "You know, I saw a dream last night." "No, you didn't. Your eyes were closed. You're only using the language of the five senses we know." So we use things around the eyes, around hearing. "I hear you, man." "No, it means you understand. It doesn't mean you actually heard the words." Or touch. "I feel you." But we're not touching each other. Mm-hmm. "I feel what you're saying, but I'm not touching you. How could I be feeling you? No, there's another sense involved, but we don't have the language for it. So he said there was 360, and that's the so-called gods and goddesses of Egypt. Isis, Hathor, whatever you want to say, Osiris, wizard, which is the proper pronunciation. Izet is the proper pronunciation. Sekhmet, you know, all of them are senses that we have within us. So here's the teaching, which is an ancient teaching, which comes back to a lot of Buddhism and Taoism, that you have to find God within before you can find God without. Well, the net is within us. His whole objective of his teaching was to awaken the senses within people. That's the right brain experience. That's why we can go to the temple of Izet and understand the feminine principle in its totality, which is what she represents. But then you meditate in her holy of holies, and you chant, and you sing, and you tone, and you get silent, and you connect with that energy within yourself. Every man is Izet. Every woman is Izet. That's the principles. That's the understanding. So yes, they taught that we talk about cycles. You see, cycles that we go through, there are five stages of the sun. They represent the daily cycle the sun goes through, but it does represent stages in our consciousness and times in our prehistory, cycles we go through as a species. And we'd say that we are in the low end of the cycle now for the last 5,000 years. The previous cycle, we were using all 360 senses. Then we could build pyramids. Then we could carve a sphinx. Then we could lift a 1,000-ton obelisk with no problem. Because if there's no gravity, there's no mass, there's no weight.
Do you think that the true story of Egypt is being covered up?
Purposely so. It is, again, what I really document in the second book. It is what we will concentrate on this tour. Working with the person that I'm really concentrating to work with now is Patricia Awayan. Patricia Lehman Awayan, she came to Egypt with me in 2005, the daughter of a great celebrated artist, a well-known artist herself in 2005. She was immediately the best student I ever had. She then became Hakim's daughter-in-law, marrying his second youngest son, Yusuf, and got to experience from him personally. And I've been doing the tours with her for the last 5 years. I want to continue working with her, and she and I are going to return to the teachings, the pure teachings, because she's the only one who really teaches it as well as I can. And that's ego, but that's the way it is. I just have to be honest, because it's difficult understanding the way he's coming from. You have to have gone the mile. This is something that, again, Land of Osiris is a preliminary, is an introduction. There's so much more, and that's what we give out now, that the teachings are about. Understanding the cycles is to understand where we've come from and where we're heading now, where we're going with this future. It's to try to give people a framework to understand what's going on in what seems like utter chaos in the world right now. This chaos is necessary for the changes that are coming in to waken people up. He used to call the time we're going in now the awakening, because we've come through a full 65,000-year cycle, and we're coming to a new dawn of consciousness. That's what all the New Age teachers, so-called, are teaching. All why there was a Jesus, why there was a Moses, why there was a Muhammad, why there's a Krishnamurti, why there was this one, not is that one. I could go on and name masters galore because I've studied metaphysics for almost 50 years now. And all of them came around in this cycle to try to shine a light to say there's more than what you've been told that's going on here. The idea is to understand these 360 senses, Hakim would say. People say, how do we awaken them? What should we do? And he would say, just to realize you have them. That you're more than you've been taught in school, in religion, by parents, by politicians in particular, who you are. That we have to waken up to who we are. We have much more than we have ever been taught we are, and that's the senses that will come. I once gave a lecture in front of 400 people where I told them, people are going to wake up in the middle of the night and know things they did not know before. And I saw in the second row, a woman was elbowing her friend like, see, I told you. There's confirmation all the time. I mean, this is why I search the internet every day, why the internet is such an amazing thing. Because, you know, I would say 90% of it is diversion. Is there just to keep people from uncovering, as you said. But it is that 5, 10%, 8%, whatever people want to say, where you see a hidden story in archaeology, something's been found around the world, or some movement over here in the world, well, something's here where a bunch of people have saved a bunch of other people, or something is happening that he told us were clues to what we're going to be the awakening, is that people are going to wake up and realize a collective consciousness instead of an isolated country consciousness, borders, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's happening more and more, and I see it most of all amongst the young people right now who have given me a lot of hope that they're getting it, that there is a bigger picture besides beyond the little isolated sphere that we've been forced in our little boxes to think that we are. And that's the detriment of social media, that people are on the little screen every day and they're not reading books anymore. At least, you know, when people post something on a post, people should always go to the links and follow it back, because sometimes you'll see something posted on a pseudo-scientific website that'll say, so-and-so discovered, blah, 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 blah. You go to the links. You go back to maybe you will find a scientific paper there that is not saying that at all to what the headline is saying. But people don't do that type of research anymore. They just look at the headlines, the sound bites. So part of what Hakim's work and what our work is about is to get people to wake up and look beyond the sound bites.
Do you think that the teachings of Moses originally came from the king named Akhenaten?
Without a doubt, that is my second book, From Light into Darkness. I actually identify, there are many, many authors who've tried to physically identify the historical Moses. And many different offerings have been up. But I offer up two in the book that were his, what you call viziers, what you'd call his right-hand men of Akhenaten. What was the vizier is, with vizier is not even a Kemetian word. Wazir. It was like the prime minister who was second in command to the person who would be what we would say king. We don't say pharaoh because there were no male pharaohs. But that's the matriarchal understanding. That's in Land of Osiris. But here he would have two agents that he had who we believe took his teachings, what Hakim and I totally agreed upon, and that's why he collaborated with me on the second book, From Light into Darkness, The Evolution of Religion in Ancient Egypt, is that what we know as the biblical Exodus was a historical event. And that historical event was the followers of Akhenaten, who we call the Atenites, being chased out of Kemet by the Aten followers, the followers who had been, the priesthood had already been in charge before, because he attempted a revolution. Now, getting deeper into the second book. But yes, to answer your question, Moses comes from the Kemetian term Misu. Misu has been interpreted by the Egyptologists to mean son or child, but it actually means the one who has defeated death. It's the origin of the Hebrew word Messiah. In English, Messiah, who was Jesus to the Christians, the Messiah. Well, the concept goes way before Jesus was born, of Messiah, of Misu, the one who has defeated death. So the name as it's come down to Moses is actually a Kemetian word, and the one prime vizier of Akhenaten was a man who had the title Ramisu, the one who has defeated death in the second stage of consciousness, which is Ra. So that was just a title given to someone, but who we believe left Kemet with the followers of Akhenaten, because he does not. He disappears into the mists of history, and there are many, 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 many theories about what happens to him, including to one that Zahi Khawass, the leader of Egyptology for a while, was trying to promote, that there's a mummy in the Cairo Museum that is the mummy of Akhenaten. It is absolutely not. Absolutely not. It is his brother, but they try to pass it off for various reasons. And but I believe who escaped Kemet and later became the leader of the Israelites, who were not the original. In my book, the second book, I differentiate between the term Hebrew, Israelite, and Jew, because they were not the same people.
Really?
Jew of the modern people. Oh, yes. The Jews speak Hebrew today, but many Jews are not from the ancient Hebrews. Ancient Hebrews were Africans. They were part of ancient Kemet. The 12 tribes of Israel were part of the original 42 tribes, which we talk about in the Land of Osiris of Kemet. Kemet, Hakim would say, was made up of 42 main tribes. And Kemet was not just Africa. It was Asia and Southern Europe. He would say Europa, too. Southern Europe, no doubt. This is why when they did the DNA analysis of Tut, they found he's 85% Western European. How could that be if he was African? He was, because the tribes had intermingled through many, many. We've had very, very pure ideas. I mean, this idea of the DNA analysis is interesting, but what they're finding out, the more DNA studies they do, the more find out that there are no such thing as pure human beings or pure races. We've been interbreeding. We've interbreeding with other sub-races of humans. We're called Denovians and even Neanderthals, all in our DNA structures. We're not a pure race, Homo sapiens sapiens. We've been interbreeding with many, many different types of beings. So that, and maybe aliens too. I mean, I don't deny that possibility, although we don't go there. Hakim didn't want to go there because he would say to, for someone to say, oh, aliens must have built the Great Pyramids because we didn't have the technology to do that, he would consider that an insult to our ancestors, the ancient Kemetians, because we're all descended from them. Again, saying that all races of people, he said, evolved in Kemet, including the white race, black, red, brown, yellow, whatever, all including a blue race, which there was, all evolved in what was then would be Central Africa. Although, you know, there's all sorts of arguments. No, white people come from the Caucasus Mountains of southern Russia, the steppes of Russia. And now there's a theory saying that ancient Australians came into Africa and the Australians came into Africa. I mean, Hakim would have laughed at all these different theories because he would be saying that we, as modern humans, are millions and millions of years old, not 40,000 years, like academia wants to tell us, and that we've been traveling around this planet for hundreds of thousands of years. There's a famous quote used by many different researchers, Gunnar Thompson, who's written great books, and my publisher, David Hatcher Childress, that the oceans were not barriers, they were highways. And this is the truth. We have evidence that the ancient Kemetians were in Peru. We have the ancient Kemetians in Australia. They're talking about Australians coming to Africa. Well, we can show that 25 years ago, Kemetian sailors shipwrecked off the coast of Australia left glyphs in what are called the Gosford glyphs. And we've proven that the glyphs are correct, are accurate for that time period. And there's nobody in Australia at this point in the last 100 years who could have known that those script is accurate for the time period it's supposed to be, that it could have forged it so that they're accurate. So we know the Kemetians traveled all around the world. Other peoples did too. That's why the pyramids and temples all around the world on these grid lines, which we call the energy lines, which are somewhat, you know, 32nd parallel for the Great Pyramid, 31st parallel, whatever it is, all around the planet. You look a band all around the planet, you find pyramids.
Did the is there a connection with the ancient Egyptians and the Grand Canyon?
Ooh, yes. Well, of course, David Hatcher Childress brought that to light, and I brought it to light in Land of Osiris. There was an article in the Arizona Gazette in April of 1909 that they had made a great find in the Grand Canyon, that they had found Egyptian artifacts. And then it was covered up. which the Smithsonian did, and there's nothing that exists of it today. There's no records in the Smithsonian of it. However, there are records in the Denver Museum of the particular archaeologist who made the find. So there are records that can trace to it, but it was covered up completely. Yes, it probably was a dynastic period, not very, very ancient people. But during dynastic times, there also is evidence that the so-called dynastic Kemetians sailed across the Atlantic, came up the Mississippi, and mined copper in Upper Michigan. Wow. And left hieroglyphs there, left markers. I have yet to see them with my eyes. With me, total verification always has to be that I experienced something. Someone always asks me, what do you think about this particular site? I can also say, well, this is what I've learned about it, this is what I've read about it. And if I've had friends that have gone and experienced it, I can bring that. But I don't give my final judgment on an archaeological site until I've actually been there. And so I have not seen these glyphs. They're supposedly Egyptian glyphs in Mayan temples. I have not seen that, but yet I have found evidences of the Maya in ancient Kemet, and that's part of what we show on tour.
The Kemetans, do you think that any of them had elongated skulls?
We haven't found any. That's a great story. That is Brian Foster's specialty. That's what he's doing the great work in. He's done a great DNA analysis. He's now made some great finds showing that he thinks elongated skull people may have come from the Caspian Sea area many couple thousand years ago, came to Peru and became the Paracas people that he studies. That's wonderful work. But I'll tell you from as far as I know, all the mummies that have been found, all the bodies that have been found, we have found no elongated skulls among any of the so-called pharaohs or kings or mummies in Egypt or aliens.
You said something about there were no male pharaohs?
Yes, the term per'ah, again, Hakim would teach the five per's, the houses. Per'ah meant the high house. It was a woman's house. The basically this civilization, that's why the Sphinx is female. She represents the Great Mother. That's the first thing they wanted to make a statue, a carving of. The civilization was matriarchal. It went from mother to daughter. The people who were plastered on the walls, the statues and all of that, were those who were chosen by the Per'ah. She, the high house, the one who sits on the throne, as Izet, Isis, sits on her throne. She gives the royalty to Wizard Osiris to be able to rule, with quotation marks. She is the rule. It goes through the woman's house, so there were no male pharaohs. Even Hakim said, in the beginning, with so-called old kingdom, maybe even through the new kingdom, they weren't kings either. They were the male chosen by the Per'ah to be her consort. So he was said to be the male head of the family that the priests were flattering by putting all these things in his tomb and this and that. But it was she who was the power all through this. And that's the basis of our teaching. Basis of our teaching, the main things we're going to be concentrating on this Hakim tour in September. And Patricia does a wonderful job in following up this teaching, is cycles. The idea that this doesn't go linear from primitive to complex, it's always been cycles. Everything in nature in cycles. Everything we know in the science of geology is in cycles. Everything in science shows that there's cycles. It doesn't go from straight to the primitive. So this is why we don't say we're in the highest end of the cycle now. We're in the lowest end of the cycle. But we can show that how they knew the priests who ran the civilization, because it was a theocracy, not a monarchy. This is why Hakim said they weren't even kings. They were figureheads. Most of these mummies that we found didn't live to be old age. They didn't come back to their bodies as they were promised. Weren't resurrected to live. There were unusual ones who stand out in history, like so-called Ramses II, like Akhenaten, who either impacted history or lived long. And so there was a lot of things attributed to their reign. But again, when someone, you turn on the National Geographic or the History Channel, and it'll say, "Oh, Ramses II had this built." That's nonsense. No king. They didn't do anything. The priests decided where it was built, where it was built, how it was built, and what for, according to the cycle, to the netter that ruled that cycle. It's a complex understanding. Again, Patricia Awoyan takes it even further than I do. She does an incredible job teaching the cycles. So that's the main thrust. And then we teach the second main thing, is that it was matriarchal, not patriarchy. Patriarchy came out of it, but it was matriarchal to the end. The first ruler of a united Kemet was a woman. The last ruler of a united Kemet way into historical times was a woman. We know her as Cleopatra. She was actually the seventh woman to hold that title. So she's technically Cleopatra the seventh. She was the last ruler. It began with a woman. So it always was. And again, on tour, it's so easy to show this. It's so easy, as Hakim would do. Give you the visual evidence, if you need the visual evidence. We can show you where the woman is primacy all the time. All the time, the primal influence is the woman behind the man, pushing the man forward, announcing him, anointing him, as Mary Magdalene did for Jesus, anointed him and declared him the Christ. It's always been that way. But patriarchy has changed it around. Like, oh no, we have to have God the Father. Our mother is gone, or she's gone. But we talk about how evolution, how patriarchy came to be. So the main two themes of there are the cycles and matriarchy. So there were no male pharaohs. Simple fact, we've all used the term wrong, including myself. There were no male pharaohs. And yet, it's so ingrained in the culture that it's everywhere. And, you know, it's going to take generations, as it does in academia. When a theory is wrong, and it's finally proven wrong, and all the evidence is mounting against it, it takes sometimes generations before all the adherents die out and the new ones come in. That's what we call a paradigm shift. And that's what we've been trying to do in this field, a major paradigm shift from Egyptology to Kemetology, which recognizes the ancient civilization well over 12,000 years ago, the ones who built the pyramids and carved the Sphinx, who didn't have any gods or any religion, but were very spiritual people, because there was no separation between the physical and the spiritual. There was no separation between them, between God and technology. It was all the same. It was all existence. Using 360 senses, Mark, hardest thing for people to understand is that they didn't have any blueprints. That's why we're never going to find any papyruses that say how the Great Pyramid was built. Nonsense. They did it all in the mind. Using 360 senses, we could think in solid geometry. The blueprints were in the mind. And the only person in modern times who fits that type of understanding is Nikola Tesla. Yeah. Nikola Tesla used to say that he would come to a point where he needed to invent a machine, a certain machine to continue a project he was on. So he would envision in his mind a black box. And he would see all the parts of the machine going into black box, and all of a sudden the blueprints would be there in his mind. And he would build a machine. And there's more patents, U.S. patents, in Nikola Tesla's name than anybody else combined.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
We couldn't be talking to each other tonight if we didn't have the ideas that he created that gave us timepieces, that gave us lasers, that gave us computers, that gave us everything we use today. There's a great physicist named Nikola Pekarik, Andre Pekarik, who stated a long time ago that Nikola Tesla virtually invented the 20th century.
Amazing. So the women are in charge in the more advanced cycles of history.
Charge is an interesting word, using a patriarchal term. It's a different type of understanding. It's an understanding that, here's a simple way to explain it. Who's the first teacher we really have?
Your mother.
Of course. Mm-hmm. Every being, every species. Who teaches a cat to be a cat? Who teaches a dog to be a dog? Who teaches us where we can go to the bathroom and where we can't?
Exactly.
Always mama. It always comes down to mama. And if you look at other species, you see that they have it together much more. You look at dolphins, the total matriarchal. The pod is run by the matriarch. You look at gorillas. You think the silverback is in charge? No, it's the oldest female.
It's the same
with a lot of other primate groups. And it's a lot of other – how I first got into the subject was long before I met Hakim. My second master's degree is in social sciences, but it's from the Women's Studies Department, which no longer exists, at San Jose State University in 1978, where I taught that ancient Egypt was a matriarchy, where descent went from mother to daughter. Long before I met Hakim, he just confirmed everything I had done for my second master's. 25 years later. But it was always, there's a long history of matriarchal studies. There's the fact that the people we call the Iroquois, that was not their name. Their name was the Haudenosaunee. They were the five nations, and they were matriarchal. And they gave us the tripartite form of government that we use, not the British. Our model of government is based on a Native American model, not it's based on British common law, to be sure. It's based upon the Magna Carta, to be sure. But it was based mainly on the idea of an executive, a judiciary, and a legislative that was from the Haudenosaunee. And the women were the judiciary. The women decided who was to be the executive, who was to be, they were called the clan mothers. They decided who was to be the chief. If the chief didn't do what they decided, they as the judiciary kicked his ass right out. So there were many, many Native American groups that were matriarchal. There's many, many Asian tribes that are matriarchal. There's many, many African tribes that were matriarchal, descended from Kenneth. And that's why there's always been that tradition in African Americans of the strong matriarch, the strong matriarchal tradition coming down from their African roots. So the idea is we were more matriarchal. Again, I'm a student of history and prehistory. We were more matriarchal in our known history and prehistory than we've been patriarchal, which has only been the last 5,000 years.
Well, let me step back a little bit and talk a little bit about King Osiris. I've heard he had a golden penis. Do you have any information that goes along those lines?
Now, where would you get that information?
I have heard that from more than one source. Is there any truth to that, or is that total nonsense?
Well, Hakim once gave a talk with me in Laughlin, Nevada. It's on video. In 1998, I actually got him to come to the U.S. And someone asked him, was Osiris a myth or a real man? And he looked at that person, and the audience was a UFO audience. Mm-hmm. So that's why they were there. And he said he was a myth.
Ah.
Hakim would always answer a question according to the level of the questioner. So were the Netters actual physical beings? Again, here comes to Eric Van Doneghan and the gods and all this and all this and all this and all this. Yes, we believe we're Our ancestors come from the stars. Yes, we believe that this place has been visited many, many times. Has our DNA been messed with many, many times? Quite possibly. But when somebody would ask him about extraterrestrials and UFOs, he would say, no, it's just myth. So that story has no basis in reality that I know of whatsoever, because there was no King Osiris. Hmm. Osiris was the mythology of the good king, of the complete. But the myth, the Nether Wizard means completion. It means unity. It has many, many different meanings that came attributed to this legendary king. But was there an actual Osiris? Hakim would say to us, to the audience tonight, it was a myth.
That's interesting, because you named your book The Land of Osiris.
Exactly, because that's what the land was called. The mythology of the oldest section of Kemet was the civilization. The area which we know from Abu Dawash in the north to Dashur in the south had the most ancient sites, the most ancient pyramids, the most ancient temples. They based it in dynastic times. When they started to give a label to it, they called it Buwizer, the land of the original concept of king or of God or of unity. Wizard, where the word wisdom and wizard comes from in English.
One thing that I realized.
But it was not to a god. No way. It was to an understanding of the oldest of the old. So that's Buwizer, the oldest section. That's why the Giza Plateau, we date back again, the Sphinx being 54,000 years old. But Hakim would even say, before it is what is known in geology, and the great geologist Dr. Robert Schock was the first one to bring this to our attention, that what is the head of the Sphinx was what is known in geology as a yardang. It would have been just a limestone outcropping. So in other words, what we see of the Sphinx today, it would have been ground level, would have been to where her neck is today. That the only thing was a natural outcropping of limestone, had no form, just naturally millions and millions and millions of years old. And Hakim would say the Kemetians coming into consciousness would come there 56,000 years ago just to meditate. Just, he would say, to energize themselves. That's why we go to these sites, to energize ourselves. I tell the people, and we usually do an introductory lecture, well, I tell a lot of people come back to Egypt to remember who they are.
That's interesting.
I did 26 years ago.
That's very interesting. Do you talk about previous lives at all?
Well, again, this is a very difficult subject. A lot of people are into that and want to. Hakim had a very different experience of that too, which was teaching of that, which was almost Buddhistic, if you know the teachings of the Buddha. Because Hakim would say there's no such thing as individual soul, as the Buddha would say, that the I, individual, ego, is illusion. But he would say that we have different life cycles. So in other words, he would teach that, like many teachers have taught, that memory is just not encoded in our brains, that memories are in our cells themselves, which have come from previous cells, from previous things. So do we identify with certain individuals in history who we may think we may have been? Yes. But we were actually that person? No. The energy that we are may have been through that person. So it's a very difficult subject to explain. And that's why in my book, the second book, From Light into Darkness, I don't explain it until the very end, because he gave us five distinct teachings. He started out saying there is no time. Time is an illusion. That everything that's in the future, everything that's in the past, is in this moment. And again, all the great masters, from Jesus to Moses to the Buddha, all down, have taught that there is only the eternal now. There's, you know, time is an illusion as far as the past and the present and the future. But then he would say there is no death, that there was no word in the Kemetian language for death, that is also an illusion, that what we are, this physical form, is not what we are. The essence of what we are has never been created and is never destroyed. So that continues, and that is consciousness. That's the very first Nether he taught me. Consciousness. So Hakim did not believe in a Big Bang theory, in that was a beginning, because there was no beginning and there is no end, just eternal cycles. So at the end, he would say, there is no soul and there is no God. But to go to those last two, I had to go through 11 chapters of my book, and still people didn't understand it, because I got criticism. Why are you attacking Christianity? Why are you attacking God? Blah, blah, blah. You know, there is no individual God. There is no creator that's outside of creation, because that's what the third law says. There is no separation. Every cause is an effect. Every effect is a cause. Everything is connected to everything else. Astrophysicists are telling that all the time. Events that happen billions of light years away still affect us in our solar system. Gravitational waves, energy waves are affecting us daily from supernovas that have occurred billions of light years away. Nothing is disconnected from anything else. So there cannot be a creator separate from creation. So there's not a personality. There's not a consciousness. There's not a big daddy with a white beard sitting on a throne who's trying to judge us every day for everything we do. As George Carlin brilliantly would say, you know, George Carlin would do at the end of his bits, he would say, I'll tell you what, if there's a God, may he strike this audience dead. And everybody do it, would go, ooh, and go, okay, I'll do better than that. If there's a God, may he strike me dead. And they say, wait a minute, I feel a little itching in my scrotum right now. But no, nothing's happened, see? So now all the God believers will say, well, God was right. So George is dead now, so God came and got him. But I'm sure George knows the truth now that he was right. I mean, but you see, this is not atheism. This is why this is pure spirituality. This is why it's so hard to discuss it with people who are fundamentalist in every aspect of religion. This is not atheism. Atheism being without God. No, it's understanding what the word God means. It comes from netter. It comes from a principle, an aspect of the divine, of the whole. There was only one time, one aspect, one glyph that the Kemetians would use that in any way would relate to what we conceive of as God, and that's the triple netter. When they used the netter three times in a row, it's netter netteru, which means all the netters together, all combined, all 360 senses. So that's God. That's what it means to be enlightened. That's what it means to find God, to know that God is within and without. Every great master who's ever walked this planet has taught the same teaching. You have to find God in a sewer, not in a church or a synagogue. That's why Rajneesh, a great master who I loved, would say, why do you have to go up on top of a mountain and meditate for 50 years in silence and then you find God? If you can't find God in Times Square at noon, you can't find God.
That's interesting. It's one of true. One of the wisest things you say in your book is that everything in nature is interconnected and interdependent. I think
that's where the word comes from. The Greeks coming in saw the term nature. It's only pronounced NTR, and nature. It's pronounced really with a catch to it, the way Hakim would pronounce it, very few people could pronounce. And they said nature. That's how what they called it. So the Latin-speaking people coming in, hearing the Greeks refer to it as nature, referred to their word natura, which is where our word nature comes from. The Greek word for nature was physis, where we get the word physics or physical. But they pronounced netter nature. And the Latin-speaking put it down as natura, nature. So netter nature it is. That's it, God, nature. How can you be God without nature? How can you, Mother Nature is God. What else could there be?
That's great. You say that in your early teens you rejected religion as a system for learning objective truths.
Yes.
Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Well, I mean, it began with my reaction against Judaism, which is how I was raised. And I come from a long line of very Orthodox Jews. I'm only a second-generation American. My father was born in Brooklyn. I was born in Brooklyn, as my brother was. But all my grandparents on both sides were Eastern European refugees coming to the United States in the early part of the 20th century to escape the pogroms and the anti-Semitism that was occurring in Europe. And my father was training to be a rabbi, as his father had trained before him and had not been. But there were many rabbis in my family, many Talmudic scholars. But I rejected it because it was so patriarchal. And actually, I mean, I could reveal this to people. And I don't mind doing this. There actually was one key thing. You must see, my father venerated his mother. His mother died when he was young. And he worshipped her as a saint. So he always taught my brother and I tremendous respect for my mother. And that's why I became a feminist. My brother has in his way too. But we became much more healthier attitude towards women than a lot of men have done in this society. Because my father taught us, mother is most important. And he did. If I ever cursed against my mother, that was when my father came down on me the hardest. So, but there's a prayer in Orthodox Judaism that a male Jew says every morning in his morning prayers, where he thanks God for not making him a woman.
Really?
And I came to my father soon after being bar mitzvahed, being admitted into the Jewish fraternity, where I said to him, I could not say that prayer in all honesty because I don't believe it. And he said, it's just archaic. You know, he couldn't explain it. It's part of the, you know, look at all the women in the, and, you know, then yeah, how, of course, Jews try to soften it. Look at all the women in the Jewish tradition, the women of the Bible, what strong, great women they were. Yeah, but they were only secondary. They could never pray alongside the men, which you can't do in Orthodox Judaism. You have to sit upstairs or in another section. They don't sit together, which was abhorrent in ancient Kemet. You could not have a spiritual gathering in ancient Kemet where women were not the central focus.
Wow.
That's the difference. So that consciousness became clear to me. And I became a feminist in the 70s, and that's what led me to having a master's degree in women's studies.
That's very interesting. How can people sign up for your tour?
Great idea. It's a website run by NEXT, who's going to be working on this video documentary with me. It's www.adept, capital A-D-E-P-T, capital E-X-P-E-D-I-T-I, adeptexpeditions.com. You capitalize the A and you capitalize the E in adept and in expeditions.com. It's filling up quickly. We are going to have a cutoff. It's not going to be a super large tour because we want to focus on real seekers who really want to go deeper into Hakim's teachings. Because, and Patricia's very excited about it too, because, you know, and I'll say this to you before we get off the air, because again, I talk to you like, as a mystic as well as a scientist. I've had greater contact with Hakim in the last 10 years that he left this plane often than when he was here. Because as he said, there is no death, and he's proven it. So he's given me many more things now, many things to add to. So Patricia's excited because this tour is going to be full bore, which we're going to be, you know, again, Land of Osiris was a primer. It was an introduction to Kemetology. And we went deeper into From Light into Darkness. I'm going to go much more, even deeper into Akhenaten now, into what he was all about, his connections to Judaism, the Rosicrucian teachings, the Exodus, what it was really all about, and a lot of things that Hakim predicted that are going to be coming up at this coming age.
And what is the date of your tour?
September 14th to 27th.
Okay.
2008. And I'm trying to get a lot of folks that have been before with us on tour and knew Hakim so that we can share a lot of stories because, and there'll be a lot of video that's going to be posted, a lot of videos that we're working with that we did with him as far back as 1992. That was a wonderful video. I sat around a circle around the Mena House pool, which doesn't exist anymore. It's a parking lot now between myself, Hakim, and John Anthony West. And we had a great conversation. In 1992, and it was videoed on a Super 8 video camera. We have that. We have video from 1998 when we did a tour together, from 1999 when we did a tour together, from 2004, and 2007 was the last tour that Hakim did with us, when Patricia was on with us, and that was videoed. And it's priceless material of him speaking.
So are people responsible to fly their self?
Yes. The tour price doesn't include airfare because people can make their own arrangements. There's ways to get very inexpensive flights to Egypt if you don't mind jumping around, going to Europe, you know, some people to Rome, some people to Germany, some people to England is a way to go. If you go Egypt there, you can go directly from New York, you can go directly from L.A., from even Canada.
Wow.
But they're different fares, and sometimes they offer different rates. But our fees are the same rate. Unfortunately, you know, the biggest drawback for people is, you know, I've had so many great people over the 20 years I've been doing tours. I want to come with you, but I can't afford it, you know. Well, as I say, it doesn't get cheaper. Every year it goes up. The tourism flatlined in Egypt in the 90s and early 2000s. 2001 directly affected as far as Americans. When they had the 2011 revolution, it flattened. And then in 2013, there was a second revolution. And so tourism is a shadow of what it once was in Egypt. It's coming back in bits and pieces, but never what it was. I mean, I can give you stories about that. We don't have time. But it's the best time to go now to experience it. But the prices don't go down because the site fees go up. They keep raising fees of sites. We rent the Great Pyramid for people. We rent the Pyramid, the Sphinx. We rent other sites. Those sites, you know, the markets have doubled and tripled. I mean, they just want the elite to be able to come to Egypt. Really, I mean, is that what the world's turning to? And that's a political statement. I don't want to go there. But it doesn't get any cheaper. So the excuse I can't afford it doesn't work. So I've given people over the years a technique which worked for me. It's a Rosicrucian technique, and I'm going to be talking a lot about the Rosicrucians on the tour. It's you visualize yourself in Egypt. Look at pictures of me. Look at pictures of Patricia. Look at us at Egypt. See yourself with us. You visualize yourself in Egypt with us. You visualize the money coming from an unknown, yet unknown source. The money comes in. Don't worry about it. You see yourself there. You really concentrate that in your meditations, maybe 10, 15 minutes a day. But the key to the Rosicrucian understanding is you have to release it. You have to give it to the cosmic. You can't keep obsessing about it. Oh, I wish I could go to Egypt. Oh, well, I've got to get the money to go to Egypt. I wish. It won't work. You have to release it. You have to let the forces activate. It worked for me. It was 25 years that I wanted to go since I went. But the money came from nowhere. Magically appeared. And I went to Egypt for 3 weeks. Went on a tour with a woman named Nikki Scully, who's the champion of leading tours to Egypt. Because she went with the Grateful Dead in 1978. That's a whole other story. The Grateful Dead knew Hakim. And the whole other story, and I tell it on tour. But, and the money just appeared. And I did this two-week tour, and I did a conference, and I met Hakim, and my life changed. So that's what can happen for anybody. Don't use, I don't have the money, as an excuse. Make it happen. Enjoy.
Have you ever considered living in Egypt?
Yes, but it would be very difficult. That's why I have great admiration for Patricia Aouyan Lehman Aouyan, because she has lived in Egypt the last 10 years as a woman. And that's an incredible experience in a Muslim culture, and coming from, as a free Western woman as she was. So Hakim always wanted me to come stay months at a time, but I had commitments that I had to work. I had commitments to family, et cetera, sure. et cetera. I would have loved, spend months at a time with him.
Yeah.
But it is what it is. I couldn't do it. But I thought about it. It would be very difficult, though. There's a lot. I mean, I could do it. I could make it in Egypt. I know I can. But there's a lot of things that are very frustrating living in a Muslim culture,
which I
don't want to go into. I won't elaborate upon here. The way women are treated, number one, of course.
Well, Stephen, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. And I know there's so much more information that we could chat about. And I hope we get the opportunity to do that. Do you have any closing words that you'd like to leave with the audience?
No, I just hope that you can join us someday. I mean,
that would be great.
The idea of this information, it has to be passed on. And that's why we're doing what we're doing for a legacy for him. Because we would sit and talk in hours into the night. And, you always say the teachings are much more important than any one of us individually. And I always have to fight that off because we all get into our ego trips. We all get into our things about it. But these teachings are pure and are ancient. And as he would say, it's not theory because we're not going to debate this. We present it for those who want to go forward with it, want to continue with it, want to understand it. I mean, they can question us, no problem. But for those who, want to debate, it's have a nice day. Because that's why I don't deal with Egyptologists.
Oh, yeah.
There's no debate here.
Stephen, have a great evening. Thanks.
Thank you. You too, Mark.
Bye-bye.